السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds. And may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. I'd first like to thank the audience for listening patiently to what I've had to say for the last two nights. And I know it's caused some confusion with a few sisters and brothers, but don't worry, there's no need to panic, and inshallah, gradually we'll understand these concepts. But always feel free to contact me by email or whatever. Those who have attended for the first time tonight, they may have difficulties with, you know, following the discussion. They may not be able to follow through it as easily. But it seems that these are being recorded, so you can always go back and listen to them from the beginning. But very briefly, what we've gathered so far, what I've tried to show, is that in relation to our origins, our destination, and our potential, there's absolutely no difference between men and women. The road to perfection is open equally to all, to its maximum. I've tried to show that the logic of the verses of the Quran and the traditions are pointing to this fact. And this is very important to establish, because only then, after establishing this logic of our texts, can we now begin to interpret those traditions which speak sometimes negatively in relation to women. We can now interpret them. It's in relation to specific women, not the whole female race. So that was just one point which I thought just to mention, that we've, until now, this is what we've tried to say. Then, last night we ended here. It was Ibn Arabi's attempt to show that not only are they equal, but women may be superior. And how Eve was superior to Adam, he gave his explanation. And then he called Eve, Hawa, alayha salam, a kind of divine seal of biological proofs, the divine seal for mankind. It was after her creation, now mankind begins. Before that, there was no guarantee. There was no hope. Through her, now mankind commences. That was in relation to Eve. And then we said in women, in general, as possessors of the womb, they're very important. They bear this important significance that men don't. Because everything happens in the womb. Ensoulment of the soul occurs in the womb. 9 months of growth from a cytoplasmic unicellular embryo, it becomes 3.5 kilograms at birth. After 6 months, it becomes 8 kilograms, 20 pounds or whatever. It's all the mother. The mother's thoughts, the mother's body, her inner cells, her blood, her thoughts, her emotions, all this is shaping this child. And this is something very important. Just on the margin here, when some people try and answer the question as to why women can't have a number of husbands at the same time, whereas men can, some return it to this fact. Because, you know, we have in our traditions that, for example, at the time of sex, if you speak or have negative thoughts, it has a negative effect on the child. Not to say that this was always the case, but The traditions are explicit. The potential is there. Now, this woman with the child in the womb is nurturing this child. Her emotions, thoughts, body, everything is shaping that. If this woman were to have two or three husbands at that time, just think how the corruption which will lead into the forming of that child. The focus has to be there. Now, this doesn't apply to men, there's no need, but for women, it's important. Now, you may say, what if she doesn't want any children? The answer is something else. We may come to that tonight, or I'll touch upon it tomorrow. Okay, now we want to slowly enter the discussion on a few very delicate traditions. The first tradition states, إِنَّمَا مَثَلُ الْمَرْأَى مَثَلُ الذِّلِّ الْمُؤْوَجِ. The example of the woman is like the example of a curved rib bone. The example of a woman is like that of a curved rib bone. إِنْ أَقَمْتَهُ كَسَرْتَهُ. If you try to straighten it, the rib bone, you'll break it. وَإِنْ تَرَكْتَهُ إِسْتَمْتَأْتَ بِهِ. But if you abandon the rib bone as it is, you'll benefit from it. إِسْبِرْ عَلَيْهَا. Have patience with her, with the woman. Let her be, let her be. Now, here at a first glance, maybe for many of you, this tradition seems quite odd. It may even sound medieval, that women, you know, comparing them to the rib bone. But when you look at it with depth, properly, trying to analyze what is expected from it, what is trying to say, then we see that one can gain a good insight into Islam's perspective on women's role in society through this one tradition. Just because it looks medieval, just because it sounds odd, don't be put off. Try to get to the inner meaning of it. So here, men are instructed, in other words, not to endeavor in straightening her, straightening the woman. Straightening, I say in quotes. They're told not to do it. Now, when we say straightening someone, it usually involves, you know, ordering them about or telling them to do this or do that, forcing them into different actions, pressurizing them into certain codes of practice, providing them with a list of chores around the house, wanting them, in some cases, to work outside the house to earn money, placing burden upon them. Now, the woman may want to do all these without the husband saying, but the man is ordered, is instructed ethically, not to want these things. Don't try and straighten her. Let her be. None of this is allowed. You can't tell her to do this, do that, do the chores, go on work, raise the children like this, like that. None of these are allowed. She has to remain as she is, like the rib bone, abandon the rib bone. She has to remain as she is for benefit and grace to emanate from her. With the rib bone, if you just leave your rib bone, you breathe normally, calmly. You want to break it, then all kinds of problems occur. So she has to remain as she is without anyone forcing her into anything. She's supposed to be totally free. See? Slowly we're entering the inner meanings of this tradition. She's supposed to be free. Hardly anything is imposed upon women in Islam. We have nothing. There are some things, our laws, rules and regulations in relation to salat, hijab, fasting, hajj, and yet these are our laws things. But as wives and mothers, you're very free, women. No one can impose anything upon you. Now, there are two things which commonly in fiqh They say they only have two obligations in relation to the husband. But even those two are nothing. Those two can be stipulated to be avoided. And those two have to be explained properly. They've been explained very negatively, unfortunately. It's the same two, but in the East they have this way of explaining it. We don't need to explain it in that way. We're not changing the Sharia, but sometimes the way of explaining things differs. What does it mean, these two obligations? And then these two obligations are, you know, against the 1,001 obligations that the man has before the woman. You can't even compare the two. She's supposed to be free. And if the man falls in any of those 101 obligations, then the woman can not accept those two in proportion to how much the man is not acting according to his. So one shouldn't make a big thing. Now there's only two obligations. It has to be explained what they are. Since I don't want to enter a fiqhi discussion in these sessions, but I've talked about it before. I'm not sure if it's on the internet or not, but these things I've discussed. But this, I have another agenda with these sessions. Now, why should such a freedom, be assigned to half of the world's population? You know, this has to be investigated. It's not, you know, willy-nilly. There's a purpose behind this assignment of freedom. Now, maybe one reason for this assignment is that for the woman on her days on earth, Islam wants to provide her with extensive and ample means to choose her own destiny. Now, yes, that also exists for men. This capacity is there, and men also want to find their destiny. But it seems that for women, this is very unreserved. This provision of freedom is very unreservedly given by the legislator. You can't compare it with that freedom which is given to men. It's as if, you know, the men are the sponsors for women to find that destiny of theirs. Because the man is, you know, from morning to night, he has a responsibility to provide for the family, for his wife. He has to work, he has to earn. The catering, number of things in relation to maintenance, everything is upon the hands of the man. True, the woman can choose to do it. If the man and wife come to an agreement that, yes, I'll do it, you can send home, that's okay. But the primary responsibility is for the man. All these things the man has to do. The woman has been freed from such, you know, shackles, so to speak. She has the choice. She's very free to opt for that choice, to choose her own destiny. Now, she can spend it as working as a doctor, as an engineer, nurse, lawyer, teacher, housewife. The world of opportunity is before her. She's totally free with that choice. Now, then they constitute half of society, women. We don't need to limit women's potential to the house alone. They can choose to exert their influence outside the house and permeate through society in different domains. It need not be limited to the house. Being limited to the house is very noble, it's very good, but we need not confine them. She's much freer than that. She can choose otherwise. Now, what should she choose though? How should she choose? Are there any signs to help her? Yes. Her bodily constitution. There's something in her bodily constitution that gives an indicator as how she can best employ her talents, abilities, and skills. The woman, by nature, in essence, is a nurturer. Like that last night's section, like Eve, Hava, Alisam, and other women through the womb. her essence, by essence, she's a nurturer. And after all, she has been granted the womb, not the man. But this is only one aspect. This womb, this physical external womb of hers, is only one aspect, one dimension to this nurturing capacity of hers. This external manifestation, the womb, indicates her ultimate essence as a nurturer. Now, it'll be premature if you limit it and confine this inner reality of hers as the ultimate, you know, her, by essence being a nurturer. It'll be premature to limit it only to bringing up babies, however noble that is. That's just one manifestation. And maybe it's the most important manifestation. I'll come to that in a minute. But there's no need to confine it, this nurturing capacity, to nurturing babies. This nurturing inner layer can manifest itself and permeate through society. And that, by that, we need nurturing teachers. We need nurturing doctors, as well as nurturing mothers. The important thing is she has to nurture. Wherever she goes, from the house to society, this is her role. And by being granted this freedom, she has to now work. Everything's open. She's free. Now she has to work on this nurturing capacity to benefit society. Now, looking into this aspect of women, one eventually acquires the insight that the woman is a manifestation of the divine attribute Ar-Rab. Rab. She's a much stronger manifestation of Rab than men are. And this becomes, we're getting closer now to some important realities here. We have the potential to be manifestations of Allah's attributes. But with each attribute within, it sometimes differs. Here it seems that the woman can express and manifest Allah's rububiyyah in a much stronger way than men can. She's a nurturer. It's part of her inner assigned makeup. So, since this capacity, this nurturing capacity, is both extremely essential to the advancement of society, and it's realized more in women, not to say it's absent in men, but it's realized more in women, Islam has given this freedom to her, providing her with this opportunity to express herself as a nurturer in the best possible way without any impediments. Leave her. Leave her to be. Let her choose how to express this nurturing capacity. If she wants, she can only nurture in the house. If she wants, she can nurture at school. If she wants, she can nurture in the clinic, in the court, in the workplace. We don't have to limit them to the house. In Iran now, gynecologists, for example, they can only be female. They don't allow men to study gynecology. They appreciate that. This is something which women can nurture in a much better fashion. There's no need for a man. When we have all these women, university students, they're now more than men. What's the need for men to enter this room? Yes, those who qualify as gynecologists outside Iran, if they meet certain requirements, then they're allowed to come and practice. But whatever field you choose, you have to nurture in that field. Now, it's this concept of freedom, this freedom I've just spoken about, and this nurturing. Now many things in fiqh become apparent. Understanding this properly, one may understand many of the underlying rationale in fiqh, behind the rulings which may seem anti-woman, the way some people express these rulings. But when you understand it based on this rationale, you say, oh no, right, okay, we accept that, yes. You know, you have to be very patient. You know, we're undergoing a very interesting times. Islam was always in the East. Now it's growing in the West. The way it's presented can differ. If we just translate how Islam is presented by the Eastern scholars in the West, yes, it will look odd at times. We're not changing anything, but we can easily change the presentation. Many things were, you know, presupposed in the East. It didn't even need explanation. They took things for granted and they kept on giving these rulings without explaining them. But things are different now. Now, listen very carefully to this part, because you may have read the rulings that they say that there's no need for women to go to Friday prayer. Rulings in relation to women, in relation to giving testimony in court, that two on a par with the one man. Not going to the battlefront, for example. And then you may say, why should this be? Okay. And we have a tradition which says, لَيْسَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ جُمُعَةٌ. Not for women is the Friday prayer. The Friday prayer is not necessary for women. وَلَا جَمَاعَةٌ, neither is congregational prayer. وَلَا أَذَانٌ, neither is the Adhan. وَلَا إِقَامَةٌ. وَلَا إِيَادَةُ مَرِيدٌ, neither is attending to the ill and sick. وَلَا اتِّبَاءُ جَنَازَةٌ, neither is attending the funeral procession. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to go to Friday prayer. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to go to congregational prayer. It's just saying there's no need for you to go. If you go, sometimes the reward is even higher as a result of your participation, as a result of the unity which is resulted. But Islam wants to make you free. Men have to go. You're free though. If you want, you go. If you don't want, don't go. 2-to-1 in the courts, it comes back to this freedom and nurturing capacity. Why? It's not that the woman is inferior to the man. It's just that Islam, first of all, even if one woman wants to go and give evidence in court, one woman, if she wants to go, she can go. There's nothing barring her, and the judge will accept her evidence. Assuming all the surrounding contexts are there, he can accept, and there's nothing barring that. One woman. But Islam doesn't want the woman to enter such places. It sees it as a threat to her nurturing capacity, suddenly taking her to the criminal courts, for example. Giving evidence is wajib when you have things. For men, if you know something, it's wajib to give evidence. Although it's wajib, Allah says for a woman, if it's one, no. There has to be two. You may say that, but what? You'll be holding on evidence though. Allah says the nurturing capacity shouldn't be compromised. That nurturing capacity in society, in the long run, is much more important than the odd case. With that nurturing capacity, you bring her to see different things, it goes against her nurturing capacity. But if she wants, she can. One woman, and the judge will accept it, if substantiated. See, these things have to be explained. Everyone keeps on referring to the inferiority in status. You have to forget these arguments. Especially with the first two discussions, that's been established now. There's nothing inferior about women. There's a purpose behind these limitations. If she wants to go to war, yes, she can go to war. But this is against that nurturing capacity. Allah says there's no need for you to go to war. in the Iran-Iraq war. Women went to war, they were active. But Allah doesn't want to put them free. Let them be free. To go to war goes against that nurturing capacity. It's difficult for them. Divorce. Everyone again hear divorce. They say only the man can divorce. Why can't the women divorce? It goes back to the same thing. First of all, women can divorce. They can acquire that right by different means. From the very beginning or even during the marriage. But the thing is, divorcing goes against women's nurturing capacity. So it gives it to the man, because we have traditions that divorcing shivers the divine throne. And by the divine throne, it means the heart. You divorce, your spirituality goes down. Okay, there may be odd cases. Divorce is rarely legitimate. It's a very last resort. You divorce the divorcer, it's the beginning of his spiritual downfall. There's no doubt about that. And because of her nurturing capacity, Allah doesn't give that to the woman. But if the woman wants to acquire the right to divorce, if you want, you can. But to shake the divine throne, it goes against that nurturing capacity of the woman. Otherwise, there's nothing against that. All the prophets were men. Allah could have easily chosen a woman to be a prophet. But no, prophethood entails wars, fighting against oppression. It goes against that nurturing capacity to be involved in different scenarios. Otherwise, there's nothing essentially problematic. That's another example of Allah just giving that freedom to women. You don't need to enter those fields. Not that you're inferior because all the prophets were men. It's nothing to do with that. It's a socio-political post, if you like, prophethood. Nothing to do because, well, it's not that because they were spiritual, therefore they were prophets. That's one element. Women can also acquire that spirituality just as much as men. Lady Fatima, alayhi salam, was higher than all prophets. Nothing to do with spirituality. These have to be deliberated upon, thought about. You shouldn't hurry into making these conclusions. The status of women in Islam is incredible. So here, Islam wants the woman to express her true identity as a nurturing person, albeit at home or in society. And for this to be expressed and manifested, it's removed all the potential obstacles. But if you use women and exploit them animalistically, if you do that, you're restricting her to attain to that true nurturing capacity. And then that will have a detrimental effect on society. Now, there's one issue, though, that is worth mentioning. And when I was actually going through this, I went through it with my wife, too, just to get her thoughts on these lectures. Here, there was a difference of opinion between me and my wife. And I'll put it to you, and we'll put it to the vote to see which one you prefer. I was of the opinion that... Oh, thank you very much for your thought. Thank you. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
I was of the opinion that maybe if the woman bears a child first and then enters society, in society she'll be a much better nurturer than if she doesn't bear children, doesn't go through that process. I'm not saying everyone has to do that, but if she becomes a mother first, she can be a better nurturer when she goes into society. My wife was of the opinion that that's not necessary. She can be as just a good nurturer if she doesn't be a mother without being a mother. Yes. So the first opinion was mine, that it's better to be a mother first. It's, if you like, much better to be a mother first and then be a nurturing doctor or lawyer or gynecologist. Whereas she says, no, it's not necessary. She can be just as. So just out of interest, those who are in favor of the first opinion, if you raise your hands. Yes. So you're a bunch of traitors then, most of you. Yes. So you're all, yes, support my wife. It's interesting, yes. Okay. Okay. وعلى محمد اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد واجب فاجر. Okay. Alright, yes, okay. Okay, now I want to go through again different traditions and now how the Gnostics have defined the woman. Here now, this is the main, the crux of the discussions now, that they define women in a certain way based on certain traditions. The first is in relation to those traditions that call her the flower of creation. Here the scholars have opened this up a bit to explain it a bit. There are two traditions, and they're both from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that reflect one dimension of the woman's existential secrets within the order of the universe. One is إِنَّ الْمَرْأَى رَيْحَانَةٌ وَلَيْسَتْ بِقَهْرَمَانَةٍ, that the woman is a delicate flower, a pleasant flower, not a قَهْرَمَانَة. Now, I'm not sure how to translate that, but قَهْرَمَان is someone who exerts a lot of, you know, force and strength, like a laborer, for example. Okay, the woman is a delicate flower, not a laborer or a champion, you know, something like that. The other tradition is أُقُولُهُنَّ فِي جَمَالِهِنَّ. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says that their intellect is concealed within their beauty. They have intellect, and this is manifested in a certain way. Now, being the flower of the universe, being the source of life, the source of prosperity, and flowers being beautiful in themselves, this intellect of theirs is to manifest through their beauty. Now, beauty has two dimensions to it, and there are traditions on this. One tradition in relation to beauty says al-jamal al-zahir, external beauty, husn al-sura, it manifests itself phenotypically, it's the external side. Wal jamal al-batin, whilst the inner beauty, husn al-sarira, it manifests itself through the traits, the inner traits. For example, having good intentions, being patient. That's inner beauty. The intellect of women is manifested through their beauty, both types, but especially their inner beauty. This is a very important role here. For men, it's slightly different. I'll come to that in a minute. So that's from on one hand. On the other hand, the Urafa say that first of all, the whole cosmos and the people in it are a manifestation of Allah's beauty. The whole cosmos is a manifestation of Allah's attributes, especially one of them being Allah's beauty. People too are a manifestation of Allah's beauty. This manifesting of Allah's beauty is manifested in people more than it's manifested in the cosmos. The person is much more beautiful, divinely, than the world is beautiful. They're both manifestations of Allah's beauty, but one is more, people. And then amongst people, the woman is a stronger manifestation of Allah's beauty than the man. Especially in relation to that inner beauty. Outer too. The woman, she is able to manifest her inner beauty outwards. At the same time, she has the capacity to preserve that outer beauty by means of that inner purification. Both are there, she has both. But the motor is that inner beauty. Now, Amirul Mu'mineen has a tradition which is incredible. The instructions which some scholars have taken from this, the advice that they have extrapolated from this is very interesting. Uqulun nisa fi jamalihin. The intellect of women manifests in their beauty. Wa jamalu rijal fi uqulihim. And the beauty of men, whilst the beauty, man's beauty of men, manifests in their intellect. The intellect of women manifests in her beauty. The beauty of men manifests in their intellect. And what does this mean? There's a very important spiritual instruction implied by this holy tradition, in addition to the explicit meaning that it has. Maybe, according to some scholars, that here the woman is instructed to manifest her intellectual capacity in the domain of her emotions, speech, behavior, manner of communication, and so on and so forth. If you just pay attention here, it's in these domains she manifests her intellect. Communication needs beauty, speech needs beauty, behavior needs beauty. Her intellect is manifested in these domains. Whilst the man is instructed, ethically, to manifest his arts or skills and so on and so forth through his intellect though. They're both in possession of Aql. I get disappointed when people for themselves read traditions that, you know, women are intellectually deficient and they think that's it now. Islam says the woman has no intellect or they're deficient. They think that's it and they're not ready to investigate more. Don't jump into these kind of conclusions. Although I touched upon this in the first session. They're both equal, intellectually, spiritually, everything. Just different ways of manifesting it. The woman is a nurturer. From that, everything else follows. Here in this tradition, it shows they both have Aql. They both possess Aql. And they're equal in this intellect. Okay, some scholars may have said, this is the logic of 50 years ago, it's nothing to do with Islam. That since men have bigger brains, then therefore they have better intellects. This is not, you know, on a par with Islam. Okay, maybe 50 years ago, science was more primitive than it is today. They didn't know a few things. But to, you know, suddenly say these kind of things, it's not necessary. So neither is superior to the other intellectually, okay? But Islam prescribes, and it's not a wajib, by the way, it's just a prescription that Islam is putting forward as a suggestion. It never says it's a wajib. It prescribes that for the woman, though, let her aql, her intellect, permeate through the arts, her talents within society, whilst the man's arts and skills be channelized through his intellect, rather being targeted towards society directly. This is a very delicate meaning in that. It's like, so this is an ethical formula, if you like, that Islam is giving to two classes of intellectual beings, suggesting to one of them to use the intellect as a means of educating, as a means of nurturing society in the best possible way, and to the other to confine their nurturing skills in the domain of the intellect. Otherwise they both have Aql. There's no doubt about that. Now Imam Khomeini in this regard has said, The woman is a grand human being, society's nurturer. Humans are discovered from the laps of women. Humans are discovered from the laps of women. And then they keep complaining, those who just, no prophet was a woman. Why is that? Well, we've explained that. But I mean, all prophets were brought up in the laps of women. Now, Allah doesn't want certain obligations of prophets, like going to war, for this nurturer to be involved in. So he chose men to be. There's nothing to say that they're inferior to men just because all prophets are men. The woman is a grand human being, society's nurturer. Humans are discovered from the laps of women. After all, she is the educator of humankind. The prosperity and wretchedness of a given society depends on the existence and status of women. By correctly educating herself, she educates humans. And by correctly educating herself, she frees nations. The source of all prosperity emanates and springs from her lap. The woman must be the source of all prosperities. But now we should get a better picture of this now, after the introduction I've given. So that's why she is deemed the flower of creation in the tradition. She gives beauty, she gives life to earth, she frees nations. Via her apl, via her intellect, she does these things. All these things was via her apl. When the woman rocks the cradle, she's rocking the cradle of humanity, ultimately. This is an important role that she has. Now, the reference made that women are the root to all blessings and prosperity that Imam mentioned can also be extrapolated from our religious teachings. Once an Arab was grieving over the fact that his wife had given birth to a female newborn, and then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, on seeing such a scene, said, وَمَا عَلَيْكَ مِنْهَا رَيْحَانَةٌ تَشُمُّهَا. She bears no harm towards you. She's a flower. You must smell her. And what this smell means, we'll come to inshallah. But it's one's ticket to heaven. In this world, one's ticket to heaven in this world. This girl that the Imam said, go and smell. Because this smelling is primarily reflecting one's remembrance of Allah. Through women, your remembrance of Allah is enhanced. This is one of those ultimate points in Irfan in relation to women, which we're going to come to most probably tomorrow. Through women, your remembrance of Allah is enhanced. The Imam is saying, she's of no harm to you. She's a flower. Smell her. Of course, it's not referring to, you can't confine this to the external smelling. I'm just going, there's something much deeper here. It's reflecting one's remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whose beauty is manifested in this female creature. So the girl, it's as if the girl is one's ticket to Allah. And we have traditions with three girls, heaven is guaranteed. These have meanings, this has to be discussed. I mean, yes. In another tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, wal banatu hasanat. Your girls are good deeds. Walbanun, your sons, ni'matun, are blessings. Girls are good deeds. Boys are blessings. He says, walhasanat, in relation to good deeds, yuthabu alayha, you'll be rewarded by means of them. Walni'ma, in relation to blessings though, yus'alu anha, you'll be accounted for them. You have to account for your sons. But having a girl itself, you'll be rewarded. With boys, it's not as straightforward. This again is reflecting that remembrance of Allah through the girl. Now, why Allah should be recalled more and more through the woman in general, we'll come to that. Another tradition we have that the Ma'soom said, أَكْسَرُ الْخَيْرُ فِي النِّسَاءِ. Most virtues, most good is found in women. Now, this can either be in relation to the possession of the extent that she possesses Allah's attributes. In certain attributes, like that of Rububiyyah, that of Jamal, and others, she possesses that much more than men. And the causes, all causes of men's spiritual growth is found in women. They are the cause of, as Imam said, prosperity. They're the cause. The effect is the man, the prophet, the good student, the patient. It all springs from her lap. Another tradition, which refers to her being creation's loved one. We have one essential, it's a very mystical tradition from the Holy Prophet, who said, حُبِّبَ إِلَيَّ مِنْ دُنْيَاكُمْ ثَلَاثٌ. Made, loved to me, that something has been made a source of love for the Prophet, are three things in your world. An-nisa, women. Wat-tib, a pleasant aroma, perfume if you like. Wa-ju'la qurrata ayni as-salat. And salat is the third. It's the light of my eyes, the comfort of my eyes. Now, the tradition says, made, loved to me. The Prophet didn't say, I love three things. It has been made for me to love three things. It's been made for us too. But look at these three things. Two of them have no bearing, have no similarity with the third. One of them is Salat. As-salatu mi'rajul mu'min. And then you say, An-nisa. Then you say, perfume. You're using women on a horizontal to using Salat. It's been made a source of love. One is Salat. And then women, you can't compare the two. That's because you commentate this tradition very animalistically. The woman here is that celestial woman, that nurturer, that manifester of Allah's beauty, through which you can remember Allah more and more. Otherwise, if it's only the animalistic, dimension, you're not made to love that. That's an instinct, that's a biological impulse. Nothing to do with Salat. It's in a very low league. Perfume also. Many of the Holy Prophet's ascensions, when he would come back, he would smell women, smell plants to recall those ascensions. He would even smell Imams Hassan and Hussein alayhim as-salam to recall those ascensions. Although with them, they themselves were heavenly too. Heavenly people have an aroma around them, not necessarily with the physical smelling, but the smelling of the heart. You have to be very careful when you commentate on these traditions. Now, so the tradition says, made loved to me. It doesn't say, I love three things. There's a difference there. Now, Ibn Arabi concludes from this difference of wording that which is a source of love to the Prophet, that which is a source of love to the Prophet is in fact Allah. Allah has assigned him to love women, to love good aroma, to love salat. Because all of them make one recall Allah. All of them are one's ticket to Allah. It's just that you have to see them correctly, understand them correctly. After all, women are manifestations of Allah's beauty. So the perfect man's love for women, the true believer's love for women, should be a consequence and natural outcome of his love for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm going to come at a tradition will come, I think, later, but now's the perfect time for that tradition, I think.
Sorry, if we can recite Rilat Salawat, we're going to fix the banner first before it continues to fall.
All right, okay, yes. Yes. Because if you do it once, some people may get tired of, and that's not very good to tire them with du'as or salawat. Yes. So, the true believer's love for women should be a consequence of one's love for Allah. Now, I found the tradition, but that, yeah, I'll bring that tomorrow, inshallah. Otherwise, why should women be used horizontally to salat in this tradition? Now, with this tradition, now it becomes evident why marriage completes one's religion. Now we're slowly getting, you see, to these delicate points in these traditions. Otherwise, if you don't pay attention to marriage, its ultimate goal, then no, it won't complete half of your religion, and it'll take the half you had, and it'll just be a downfall from the very beginning. Just merely marrying, it doesn't mean. When the traditions say a married person, two units of a married person is, let's say, 70 times more rewarding than that, that's if you understand women in this light. If you see, with the marriage, now you have the woman day by day along you, it makes you recall Allah's attributes more. It's one's ticket to Allah. But if you don't see women in this light, no, it won't complete your faith. Because those attributes that the woman has, you don't have alone. The man is alone, can't reach Allah as good as if he finds Allah through the attributes of the woman, who is a manifestation of Allah's beauty, nurturing, and so on and so forth. In marriage, in a purely canonical setting, in marriage, the means is to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Through one's wife. This is the goal in marriage, in permanent marriages. Through your wife, day by day, you should get closer and closer to Allah. But if it's an animalistic marriage that you want and you confine yourself to, there's no doubt you won't get closer and closer to Allah. Marriage is mustahab. Something very important. This one is. Anyway, so through this marriage, it's one's ticket to Allah by recalling Allah more through the woman, those attributes that she has that manifest Allah more and more. This phenomenon we see in a lot of canonical rulings. Yes. Remember the first tradition I started off with, where we compared her to the rib bone, and then the tradition said, let her be. If you let her be, and she finds her own destiny through her nurturing capacity and as a manifester of many of Allah's attributes. If you let her be and let her do that, you will get closer and closer to Allah. But if you break her by giving her so many chores, so many duties that it's not even wajib upon her, you're limiting her access and her potential to become those manifestations. And as a result, you're limiting yourself to reach Allah. Just one marginal point. In the Sharia, I may have mentioned this before other places, but in the Sharia, everything you think of, in the rulings that many may think at first are very dry or boring, everything has inner dimensions to it. Forgive me for giving this example, but let me just... You've all heard of the concept of janaba. And when we say janaba, oh, why do you want to speak on this on the mamar, please? We don't want to think about it. Or menstruation, all these different things, all these have incredibly important inner dimensions to them. Janaba means love of the world, esoterically. Because at climax you forget Allah. You're engrossed in the world now, for a moment of time. There's no Allah in the picture. Look, compare it with wudu. In wudu, during the day when you're at work and everything, you forget Allah. It's very difficult to recall Allah from moment to moment during the day. Then the salat you do, your wudu, when you do the wudu, it's not for the sake of wudu, it's for the sake of Allah. You're recalling Allah when you're washing your hands and everything. But it's only a few limbs. Because, you know, you were working, you were still recalling Allah, but okay, you may have forgotten now and then. And it's recommended to do the wudu a lot, even if you have wudu. With ghusl, though, it's different with janaba. There was a moment that you totally forgot Allah. There was no Allah whatsoever. There were some acts, that those acts, in moments of it, you're totally engrossed in other than Allah. There, we're not instructed to do the wudu anymore. They say do the ghusl. It's the washing of the whole body now. Because for a moment of time, you were totally disconnected from Allah. You have to get back on. The Holy Prophet never received revelation in the bedroom. See, these are inner truths behind this. So because of being totally engrossed in other than Allah, then you're instructed to do the ghusl now, after janaba. The ghusl also has du'as to it. But unfortunately, these things are only confined to the material things. We're not explaining these things properly. Menstruation has the same story. It has inner realities behind it. Women have to recall from month to month. Very important. Everything in fiqh has these inner realities. Okay, with your permission, I think I'll stop here because we've reached a certain point and I'll continue inshallah tomorrow. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala ta'ala.